Well, hey everyone, it's Nate. Today is Friday, April 23rd, 2021, here in Sydney, Australia. And I'm coming to you on a special episode, unfortunately. A few hours ago, we received word that former guest and friend of the show, Les McEwen of the Bay City Rollers, passed away. Now, Les apparently passed away earlier this week. His family tweeted that out on Les's official Twitter account, and our sympathies and condolences absolutely go out to them. Today, I wanted to replay a conversation that Les and I had a few years ago. In 2018, Les was getting ready to tour Australia, and he and I got to have quite an extensive conversation on what it was like being a Bay City Roller. Now, this is a band that sold over 100 million records worldwide, with fanatical fan worship that only approached what the Beatles experienced at the height of Beatlemania. The band was carted around in Brinks trucks, you know. There was a lot of dangerous situations, and Les talks about that today. The band also was a pop sensation without the money or means to really protect themselves and their families. So that is quite an interesting bit of conversation that we get into today. Of course, they had the dodgy managers. They got bilked out of millions of dollars. But he seems to have had quite an amazing life throughout it all. And Les talks about that today. Again, I want to share this with you. It was an honor to have Les on the show. So that's what I'm going to share today. A bit of a rerun all the way back from 2018, episode 126, our conversation with Les McEwen. Rest in peace, Les. So today on The Vinyl Guide, we have on the show Les McEwen of Bay City Rollers, a man with an absolutely amazing career. Mate, you've pretty much seen it all now, haven't you?
Yeah, probably, yeah. Yeah, I've seen all of what I wanted to see in the world. I think there's nowhere I haven't been that I want to go to. So... yeah, and I'm looking forward, of course, to coming back to Australia.
Oh, well, we're looking forward to having you. Now, you've been to Australia several times, and including with the Bay City Rollers. The city went a bit crazy for you that first time, remember?
Yeah, it did. We were shoved into different vehicles to try and avoid the fans. A couple of limousines got destroyed. I seem to remember we were... ended up in the back of Brinks Matt kind of type money truck that was like, you know, really hot, and it was really sweaty in there. It wasn't a good experience being cooked in Melbourne and Sydney.
So they had to bring you with like one of those Brinks money trucks. That's how they locked you up.
That's
and transported
right, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Now, you've had some incredible highs and some devastating lows in your career, and the fact that you're here to talk about them and still touring, still doing the work, I mean, really, much respect to you there, Les.
Well, thanks very much. I try my best.
Now, I've heard the figure of 70 million records sold worldwide. I think BBC said it was closer to 120 million. And then I've heard figures as high as 300 million records sold. What do you reckon the proper figure is on that?
To tell you the truth, I have no idea. I just wish that I hadn't been paid, a dollar for everyone that was sold. It's hard to really find out what the true figure is, because for a lot of years there we were in arguments with our record company, and that was pre-computerized records and all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of guesswork, I suppose, went into it. So I don't think anybody really knows exactly how many records the Bay City Rollers sold.
Well, it was a hell of a lot, and it sounds like you got paid for about 17. So now, are you still in that sort of legal embroilment with record companies, still trying to chase those dollars, or is that just all behind you now?
That's all behind us now. We're good mates now with the record company, settled with us, and we're actually starting. Let me see, I think that 3 years now I've been getting royalty checks from the record company, and that's the first royalty checks I've ever had in my whole life. So
wow.
I'm happy every time a little letter from Sony come through the door.
Now, obviously, that's your personal business and you don't need to reveal the details, but the money that you're getting now from royalties, is it life-changing money or is it just kind of a welcome addition on top of the existing stream you have coming in?
Yeah, it's just a good little top up. I mean, it's just nice to be getting royalty checks, you know, and be, for so long my career, I didn't have a royalty check for all the work that I put into the Basic Rollers, and it was a bit annoying, you know what I mean? But so now everything's happy, easy going. I make most of my money from touring. I tour quite a lot, and so the little bits that come in from the record company is quite welcome.
And you're touring now as Les McEwen and Bay City Rollers. Is that a blessed entity with the other former Bay City Rollers, or are there multiple Bay City Rollers touring companies?
No, there's no one else doing it. Eric Faulkner was doing it for a little while, but he doesn't do it anymore, so there's only it's only myself, really, that's doing it. Alan Longmuir does a little one-man show up in the Fringe Theatre in Edinburgh every year, a little kind of show that he put together called And I Ran With the Gang. But nobody's doing what I'm doing.
His is more like a spoken word type thing, is that what it is?
Or? Yeah, and they've got a little kind of, they've got these actors who play the various members from the old, you know, from the Rollers. And they do some songs in it and all that kind of stuff. You know, they talk about Alan when he founded the band and when he threw the dart at the map of America, how they got the name Bay City and they put it together with the Rollers, all that kind of stuff. So it's interesting. I've seen it myself. It's quite fun.
What was it like watching another character play you up there? Did they get a handsome guy at least?
It's just weird. I mean, I'm working all the time. I mean, I've never really stopped working, so it's hard for me to kind of see myself from another person's perspective, because I'm just so much involved in it all the time myself. You know, every week I'm out doing at least three gigs every week. In theatres over here, I like plenty of theatres in the UK because they're a real comfortable place to be. You know, it's like home from home, really. Mm-hmm. and you get to meet theatre-type people and, you know, oh, how you doing? Oh, you're back again? Yep, okay, yeah, no problem. You know, get a cup of tea on, like, you know, big, nice, comfy dressing rooms, all that kind of stuff. None of this cheap trick rock stuff for me.
Okay, they're treating you with some respect, and that's good. So,
oh yeah, it's good.
So let's go back a bit. Let's go back even before Bay City Rollers. When you were a young boy, were you raised in Scotland?
Yeah, I was born and bred in Edinburgh. My parents were from the north of Ireland. They came over to start a bit of a new life here in Edinburgh. My mum was a seamstress. My dad was a tailor. That's how they met in some place in Belfast. I can't actually remember what it was called. But, yeah, they came over. All my brothers are born in Scotland. So I've got three older brothers. Mm-hmm. I'm the baby.
And was it a musical household?
Yeah. I mean, all my brothers were either in a band or playing music. There was always music on in our house. My mum was a great singer. She was in Belfast Women's Choir. She sang falsetto, so I think I got most of my memories of, you know, being a very young baby was my mum singing beautiful Irish tunes. I think I sort of picked it up from her, and I started singing, and then then people would say, "Oh, you've got a good voice, man. You could be a singer." And of course, every time we would watch the pop stars on the Top of the Pops, and then we'd copy them singing it. And I just started singing everywhere. You know, I had a I had a job delivering milk in the morning, so I was kind of a bit of a singing milk boy. I'd sing the horse, because we used to have the horse was at St Cuthbert's. The horse pulled the milk around Edinburgh.
Mm.
So it was quite fun.
Oh, so who were your idols at that point? Were you buying records? Did you have a little collection of pop music?
No, I wasn't that rich. I think one of my first records I bought was Whiskey in the Jar by
Thin Lizzy.
Thin Lizzy.
Well, that's a great choice. That's a great starter.
Yeah. And we used to get, you know, really listening to the radio was a big thing, you know, because where we were, there wasn't a lot of money going around to be buying records with, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd be glued to the hit parade on a Sunday from was from Radio Luxembourg, and then of course you had your BBC Radio 1. We'd do the charts every Thursday, I think it was, and then you had Top of the Pops, which is the only TV show that had music on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all different back then.
Were you familiar with Bay City Rollers before you joined the band?
Well, they were they were an Edinburgh band, and they had one hit song, a top 10 song called Keep On Dancing. And they were a bit of a kind of like, well, kind of one-hit wonder type band by the time I was, like in 1971, 72. I was in my own band called Threshold, and it was in 1973 I got offered to sing with the Bay City Rollers. So it wasn't like, wow, you know, this is a big time. It was like joining a band that had seen better days, sort of thing. But they had a good hit song up their sleeve, though, a song called Remember. And I put my voice on that, and that got released in the early 1974. And that started us on a new life-changing kind of career.
Now, I think most people are familiar with the roller mania. I mean, the world just exploded around Bay City Rollers. But when you joined the band, like you said, they were a bit of a turnaround. They were a fixer-upper. How soon after you recorded and joined the band did things start getting a little bit crazy around you?
Well, pretty much almost right away. The kind of gigs that they were playing back then were kind of working men's clubs and stuff like that. So they weren't the kind of places you would find teenagers. And the set list had lots of cover tunes in it. And, of course, also the one that they had the hit with, the Keep On Dancing. And so it was pretty hard slog, really, with these kind of very late at night kind of clubs were a bit smelly and stinky and all that kind of stuff. So it wasn't very glamorous. And pretty soon we started getting bookings in the early evening in some of these dance halls, which then a lot of people would come with their mums and stuff like that, because we're a pretty young audience. We started a kind of a mania started to occur almost straight away, maybe by about springtime in 1974. Roller mania was sort of underway, and we're getting chased around the streets and stuff like that.
Yeah, what was there an instance or something that, you know, happened that just made it apparent that things were no longer going to be the same?
It was kind of not one thing, really. I think, of course, getting on the television was very important, and we got on a show called Cracker Jack, which was aimed, that show was aimed at school type teenagers. So once we got on that, you know, once you were on television, you were like famous because you were on TV. And it was just slowly, but actually, when I think about it now, it actually happened quite rapidly. I mean, we would be playing early evening shows where we'd be getting screamed at And we might be still having to perform some of the old gigs that were in the books, you know, working men's clubs. So it was a wee bit kind of strange, that kind of crossover period where we were on telly, we were getting, our song, remember, was in the charts. We were, you know, we were on top of the pops. And I mean, that was just, you know, back then when you only had that one TV show, if you were on it, you were like mega famous just because you were on that TV show.
Yeah. Did you have that curse of like the fame, but not the means to protect yourself? Like, I mean, you'd still have to walk home, perhaps live with your folks at that time.
Yeah, there was a little bit of that going on. You know, you had to come back down to earth. You know, one minute you were flying, you know, across Europe to be on TV shows and exotic places like Finland and Sweden, and then you would be back home and, you know, back to your little flat that we had where we were brought up. So, yeah, there was a bit of a reality check every time you came back. But we were kept rather busy because back then you didn't have videos to do your promoting and stuff like that. You had to physically go to all these companies and you had to physically go to, you know, radio stations to be interviewed and all that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of physical work that went into it as well.
It always amazes me when I watch those old videos of like the Beatles. They'll play a song live and then in between songs they'll move their own amps around. They don't have people to really do that. And so was that kind of like after you played the show, were you guys moving the amps or were you guys allowed the freedom, the liberty to get out and be rock stars?
Well, from when I joined the Basic Rolls, they had their own roadie who was also the guy who set up the whole stage. He was also the guy who mixed the sound at the front. And he, you know, so there would be him and a couple of local helpers. I don't think we ever had to move amps around much. I still do a little bit of that today when if they're in the wrong position. they had their own roadie. That was another reason for me joining it. They had their own PA system, their own equipment. They had a whole bunch of gigs lined up. So I was earning money from day one. Mm. And also, I kind of had this idea that I would acquire some kind of, authority, you know, like I'm now in a professional band, so I'm now a professional singer. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Were you treated as an equal when you came in?
Oh, no. I was the loudmouthed brat.
Deservedly so, maybe?
Well, I think those other guys, I mean, there's a couple of outspoken ones were Eric Faulkner, who was kind of like their kind of the leader, you could say. Mm-hmm. And I don't think a couple of guys took very kindly to me coming in and being at the front, if you know what I mean. Because, you know, I was a bit cocky, you know, as most teenagers are. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really hold them in high regard that much because of the way they talked down to me. So it was a little bit of friction there, but it soon went. Mm-hmm. I should establish myself as the front man, so.
Yeah.
All.
Well, it's always that lightning rod position, of course. But the thing about Bay City Rollers is each person kind of had their own personality. Each person got to be in the magazines. There was the attention
That's right.
was pretty well spread around, yeah?
That's right. That was by design.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked, you know, because, you know, people, fans like different characteristics of the different guys in the band. So maybe some people like quiet ones, some people like noisy ones. I think I attracted the noisy ones.
Now, when Roller Mania started getting huge, did it get dangerous? Were there instances where you guys were really worried about like getting crushed or getting out of a crowd alive?
Yeah, there was a couple of times when, you know, the reality of what was happening outside the vehicle you were in was kind of scary, you know. We had a couple of limousine roofs caved in on us where fans, in fact, I think one of them actually happened in Melbourne, I think.
Hmm.
And that was pretty scary because, you know, just the sheer weight of human beings all trying to get into this limousine. And you just, for a minute, you just sort of think to yourself, Jesus, that could have been really bad, you know. As far as I know, I don't think there was a lot of people hurt at our concerts and stuff like that. There was a lot of good security. So there was a lot of that.
Did you have like a 24-hour security team? Were they with you pretty much all
yeah.
the time?
Yeah, all the time. Couldn't get away from them.
you tried quite a bit, huh?
Yeah, it was kind of annoying sometimes.
So tell me about a time that some fans really crossed a line. I mean, did they try to seek out your family or find you at home, any of that?
Oh, yeah, all that and above. I mean, we had people being recruited as housemaids at hotels when we were in Germany. So they would get a job at a hotel just so that they could try and get to see the Base of Rohrs.
Mm-hmm.
It was really weird. It was kind of creepy in a way. Sometimes some of the things that the girls got up to, anything to get close to a roller, you know.
And apparently there was a broadcast from London at a point where the band was looking to get attention from the American fans, and there was a riot, and it was alleged that you were injured and had to go to the hospital. Now, there's a rumor that that was just a stage thing. It wasn't true. It was just for the news. Were you actually hurt, or was that a bit of a publicity stunt?
I think that probably was a publicity stunt. I can't even remember that. But no, nobody ever got hurt. None of the guys in the band. And I think if any of the audience were hurt, it would be minor kind of scuffles. Yeah, there was always quite a lot of security at our gigs.
So really, within like a year and a half or so, you went from obscurity to having huge number one hits, even having your own television show. As a young man, how did you deal with that?
I think I'm still dealing with it. I think it's kind of weird because been singing since I could remember, and then when I was invited to leave school at 15, I joined my first band. I couldn't wait to get away from school and get singing in a band, and so it kind of was a consumption. I was just like involved with music all the time. You know, if it wasn't singing in a band, you were running your mates, listening to, you know, the latest album from David Bowie or discovering new music. So the whole world, my whole world was just music, 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 you know. And it's been that way for the last 47 years.
But a young man in his very formative years, he's really kind of going through these experiences that very few people get the opportunity to do. And it can really mess with a young kid's mind. Were you able to navigate that?
Yeah, I think, well, I was maybe... didn't quite explain it really very well, but it's kind of like you know, you go to other people's concerts. Like I went to see Queen when they first started and they were touring with the Spiders from Mars, and you could see the kind of reaction that artists got on the stage, and it made me want something similar. And so it was kind of like, all right, so that's what happens when you get famous. People want your autograph. People, you know, scream at you or whatever. And that's the kind of thing that you almost expect that to happen when you're famous.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't so much of a big surprise. It's just like, oh, that's what's supposed to happen, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, how did that affect you and, like, your relationships with your friends or your brothers?
Oh, well, it was all good when it was happening. I was everybody's flavor of the month until the roller sort of, like, stopped being as famous as they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was a bit rough at the end of the base hitter rollers. Let's see, it would have been about 77, 78, something like that. Mm-hmm. That was a bit of a hard couple of years following that. And I think basically just had to readjust to a new way of life. And I got back on the microphone, started singing again, wrote and produced 3 solo albums. So it was just back doing what I was used to doing. It was just not with the basic rollers anymore.
You mentioned listening to a lot of Bowie and just mentioned Queen. Was the Bay City Rollers music satisfying for you at the time? Was it what you wanted to?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I really do. I still think that Shang-A-Lang is one of the best pop songs ever. Mm-hmm. The kind of sound image that Shang-A-Lang has is just perfect for those kind of young days when you were in a gang and you're running around being a little bit naughty sometimes. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I had a really good feel about it. And of course, you know, your musical tastes change, and sometimes you want to experiment with do different music, which I've done over the years. I've had a little bit of an experimentation myself, but I think playing or reproducing the basic roller songs the way we do it now, as close to the original records as possible, I think that gives me a great sense of achievement somehow. You know, when you go out every night, well, not every night, but when you're playing in the theatres, mm-hmm. and you go out and there's a sea of happy faces, everybody wants you to be your best, everybody's got great memories of their childhood with you, you know, you're part of people's history, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's a really great buzz.
Now you have the band backing you, professional musicians, they're there, they know the songs, the audience knows the songs. Back in the day, did the Bay City Rollers play their own instruments live? Or were there backing tapes? Was there any assistance in that?
No, there was. They could all play, but they were just not up to the level of a session musician, let's say. On the first album, Rolling, all the songs, all the record releases was just me and the record producer and session musicians on it. But the guys could all play their own instruments, but just if you were going to have the band record a single, it would maybe take 2 or 3 days to get it right, whereas a session musician would be in and out in half an hour.
Well,
you know what I mean?
You were one of the only guys who came in as a musician, right? I mean, you had the trained voice. They were not as, I guess, mature at their instrument as you were. So in the studio setting, what you're saying is they did play. It just took them much longer to get it right.
Yeah, and back in those days, the record company wouldn't be prepared to spend the amount of money it would cost to have the band play on the records, you see, because they wouldn't want to spend the amount of money it would take to get, let's say, a golden performance out of the guitarist might take days, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think that the way they did that, they had some great session guys on our stuff. I mean, Clem Cattini, the drummer, and stuff like that. They were great guys, and of course I got to meet all of them because I was the only one that was required at the time.
The other guys had to go relax at the pool or something. Now, when we talk about Bay City Rollers, we think about them, there's that squeaky clean image, including, you know, guys always drinking milk, always, you know, this very wholesome image that, of course, you had to have targeted, you know, to the market you were targeting to. But what was really going on? I mean, you have 5 young men at the peak of their testosterone. You know, what was happening that the cameras didn't see?
Oh, well, I don't think I can go into too much detail on that one, sorry.
There was a lot of
goings on. you know, the image of the band was to be protected. Mm-hmm. And we had this Svengali manager who was a right animal, and he would come round and make sure you never had contact with any girls. You know, he would literally protect the band from getting contact with any girls. And I had a girlfriend, but she was to be kept behind closed doors and all that kind of stuff. And a couple of the other guys, a similar kind of thing happened with them. But, you know, the temptation out in the road is pretty high. Mm-hmm. And so we did, let's say, we did a bit of sowing the seeds of love in and around the world. Mm-hmm. But not too much of it. It was always supposed to be, you know, like anything that went on would be hidden from the public.
Were there ever any instances where word of an activity or an event almost got out, pictures almost got out, and the manager had to scramble and get them back somehow?
Yeah, probably, but that would all happen behind, you know, without our knowledge. Whatever was going on, you know, all the managers and the conniving and the backdoor deals and all this kind of stuff. We never really got wind of all that kind of stuff. It just was either there or it was gone.
Certainly you guys must have rebelled at some point.
Well, it was a bit of rebellion going on. Not too much of it, really. I was quite happy with my lot. I mean, I didn't really get too much kind of bullying from the manager because I was the front man, you know. So I think he did bully some of the other guys, you know, sort of scare them into behaving themselves sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But not with me so much, because I would just tell them where to get off, you know.
So you had a bit more power than the others, then?
I think so. I think it was there because, you know, you're the face of the Bay City Rollers and you're the singer on all the songs. So he would think maybe very carefully about how he would treat me. And whereas maybe the other guys, maybe they thought that they could be replaced or something like that. Do you know what I mean? So there was a bit of terrorizing going on from the manager. You know, he was famous for that. Mm-hmm. Amongst other things.
Yeah, Tom Patton, he seems like, from what I've read, he seems like a real scumbag.
Oh, yeah, definitely number one scumbag.
Have you ever danced on his grave?
I've never been. He died quite some time ago. I forget when he died. Mm-hmm. Maybe 10 years, maybe 7 years. Something like that. Yeah, no, I don't think anybody will miss him. Of course, it's never good to talk ill of the dead, but he's someone that I feel I don't have any problem.
In this case, we'll make an exception, yeah. So from what you're saying, I'm gathering that you did have a little bit extra pull in the Bay City Rollers and some of the others, simply because you were the front man, you were the face, you were probably on 30% more magazine covers than the rest of them. Did the rest of the band come to resent that at all?
I wouldn't really be able to answer that. I mean, I think there was a lot of jealousy going on, mm-hmm. was aimed at me. But I myself, I just was doing my own thing, you know. I was pretty much ignored what they were all doing. I just was doing my own thing. You know, get on the TV, you know, happy smiley faces, sing the songs, get out there, make the girls go wild.
I would think that spending all that time together, being secured away from Roller Mania, I would assume that would have drawn you guys closer. Did that happen? Were you close to the other members of the band, or was there a lot of tension there?
I think there was a lot of tension. I never really felt very close to anyone in the band. Maybe Alan Longmuir was about the closest, who I still perform with Alan sometimes. We've kept in touch all these years. He's just a normal guy, and he doesn't seem to have any hang-ups mm-hmm. that would cause any problems between us. So So, yeah, I think we missed out on a lot. Maybe we missed out on a lot of potential friendships because of the way people were kind of almost put at odds with each other. And that was the management, you know what I mean? He would be whispering in someone's ear something about somebody else's, you know, spread little stories. And, you know, if you, who knows? I mean, it's hard to even think what kind of stuff that Tampate got up to, because you need to even have a brain like his to think like he was thinking, you know what I mean? Like he's just evil.
He sounds like a very manipulative person, and at that age, you wouldn't have even known what to look for.
That's right. Yeah, it was bad news. So it was, but I mean, the thing that was great about the Basic Rollers was a whole bunch of happiness happening when we got to the concerts, you know, so that kind of more than compensated for all the crappy stuff that was going on.
Yeah. Looking back, do you feel that you enjoyed your time with the Bay City Rollers while you were with them?
Yeah, I think I did. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of like, was it a band, but you really were like, it was the audiences that, that you kind of felt more friendly towards, if you know what I mean. They made it all just brilliant. And they still do, even now. These days, it's just great to be able to have had that history, that friendship that's went back, well, over 40 years. So it's great that I've still got lots of people who want to come and sing along with me and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
Look, it's lasted a long time.
I'm looking at some of the dates that you're doing in the UK and Australia. You're playing some large places. I mean, 1,000 plus seaters. That must be really satisfying for you.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's just hard work, you know. I've just been doing it, and I've got better at doing it as well. So, and you know, and got a band that's really working really well with me now. All great singers as well, so I've got the sound. Well, I've had it now for years, and I'm really spoiled. I've had some great musicians in the band, and we all get on really, really well, you know. And I mean, it's just ideal. If the original band was like this band, it would have just been brilliant.
Who are the people that are coming to your show?
Well, they're obviously they'll be the fans from days gone by, and a lot of guys come to the shows now, and some of their kids come. Lots of young people come to our shows and want to find out what was it all about, you know, see a bit of history. So there's mainly women who were fans of the original band make up the majority of the audience.
And that's got to be doubly satisfying for you.
It is. And it's just quite amazing because some of them even go and tour with us, if you know what I mean. You'll see maybe the same faces on 10 consecutive gigs. So they take it very seriously.
That's amazing. Is the Bay City Rollers fan club still going strong?
Well, it's all changed now with the internet and all that stuff. I've got a like page on Facebook. I've got a Twitter feed and all that kind of stuff. That's the way we communicate now. But there is no fan club as such. It's just through social media.
Mm-hmm. When you were in Bay City Rollers Mach 1, let's say back in the day, music was changing at that point. Punk was emerging. Were you guys aware of that?
I think everybody got aware of punk seemed to just suddenly be the next big thing. It was just, one minute it was all nice and easy with the 70s kind of music, and then suddenly punk came along, and that just destroyed everything, you know, from Led Zeppelin's touring to every band. It was punk was the latest thing, and that was, and everything that had come before it was suddenly out of fashion. Mm-hmm. So it was a bit of a wake up call in a way. You know, for us, though, I think, when was punk really happening? Was it 76, 77?
Something around there, yeah.
Yeah, See, we had a kind of extended kind of... We were famous in the UK, 73, 74, then Europe, 75. Then it was more like Australia, Japan, America, 76. So we were already over there in America when punk hit the UK. And it didn't come to America for a little while after that. So we still had a kind of... Our career was still expanding in America when punk really hit in the UK. So we didn't feel the punch so much because we were in America, touring America, you know.
Also influencing some of the American bands. I can't remember exactly where I heard this, but if you line up Blitzkrieg Bop to Saturday Night, it's almost the same exact sequence of events. It's almost the same kind of song with just slightly different attitude.
The Ramones were big fans of the Bay City Rollers. I knew their manager, Danny, forget his surname, he was also...
Danny Fields.
Danny Fields, that's it. And he was also in charge of 16 Magazine or something. Maybe he was the editor, I can't remember. But he used to tell us stories about the Ramones would sound check to... they would be played Shang-A-Lang and stuff like this at their sound checks. And, of course, they loved Saturday Night. There's quite a few bands, actually, when I think about it, have written about, being influenced by the Bay City Rollers.
So the Bay City Rollers are like this cultural touchstone. I mean, you hear them talked about on The Simpsons, you hear them from different places, and even today, they're still a very well-known... like I said, cultural touchstone from the 70s. Are you able to appreciate that? Does that make you smile? Does it? What reaction do you have when you see something like that or hear something like that?
It never fails to surprise me when you talk about The Simpsons and stuff like that. You know, I mean, these are programs that I would watch, and then suddenly your name pops up in it and you go, wow. And I had no idea that was going to happen. But, it's very difficult for someone like myself to see the importance of what I've achieved and how it's affected other people's lives and stuff like that. So it's kind of hard to see yourself as others see you, as Robbie Burns once said.
The touring that you're doing now, and again, filling those 1,000-seat-plus theaters, it must feel like a bit of a victory lap, like all the hassle, all the problems, all the difficulties, the highs and the lows. It's really must be bittersweet at this point.
Well, I mean, just being able to work has literally saved my life when I was a bit bad with the alcohol. And starting to work hard again helped me through all that. So I've got my work to thank in many ways, really. For my health, for my happiness, and for my bank account.
And are you still in touch with the other Rollers? Do you get along with them?
I tried to get everybody to do a kind of Christmas run of shows in 2015, but Eric Faulkner wasn't very well at that time, and the drummer, Derek Longmire, didn't want to do it. So we ended up with Woody, Alan, and myself, and we did reunion shows, Basic Road reunion, I think 6 shows, from Edinburgh, Glasgow, London, that kind of thing. It was okay, but it just didn't feel right. It kind of was, you know, old stuff from the past. It just didn't feel right, and we didn't really get on very well. Well, in fact, me and Woody did get on very well. He has got a kind of like interfering people always try to get things, change things, basically. You know, he and the other guys, they haven't performed for the last 25 years. And I've been doing it, so I sort of, I think I know what I'm doing.
You've kept the flame alive, people, really. I mean,
yeah. And when people come in with their out-of-date ideas and try to fix something that isn't broken, it really is kind of slightly annoying, if you know what I mean.
So you did try it. You're in touch with them. But, yeah, there's no hope of Woody or any of the others going on tour with you.
No. I mean, Alan's been on tour with me off and on. Sometimes, I think it was about a month ago, I had Alan come on for 3 shows. That was quite fun. But he's no spring chicken anymore, and he's turned 70 years old. So, I mean, it's not too easy to be on the road. You know, you've got to travel all these different places. You've got, you know, 4 hours, 5 hours driving somewhere. Yeah, you've got to get your sound check together, you know, get ready for the show, eat something, you know, do the show, then you're back in the car again somewhere else.
Yeah, it's hard work.
So it can be tiring.
If you had to look back at your time with Bay City Rollers and change one thing, what would it be?
Oh, well, the thing is, you know, all these movies that if you change one thing in history, it could have the potential to change lots of things. So I'm not quite sure what I would change, because maybe the whole thing wouldn't have happened even with some minor change. You know, I think I could do without all the bad stuff. I mean, of course, everybody has bad periods in their life, and so I could take all that stuff and throw that out. And just keep all the good bits.
Oh, sure. Okay, so let's pretend the space-time continuum, you will not affect the future by changing something. Is there anything that you would like to do differently?
I think if I could have changed anything, it would have been the manager. Mm-hmm. I think he ruined quite a lot of people's lives, and probably still has an effect on quite a lot of people that he, you know, abused when he was around, when he was alive. So, yeah, I think he the world could do without him.
So, Les, thank you so much for spending time with us today here on The Vinyl Guide and sharing those stories. You've had this incredible life. I mean, something that certainly as a young boy, I saw the Bay City Rollers on the cover of all those magazines and running around and just looked like having a lot of fun. Obviously, it was a lot of work and a lot of complications behind it, but you've lived a big life. You've seen the tops of the mountains, and in some cases, you've seen the valleys too. But it's great to see you still working. I want to call people's attention. Les and the Bay City Rollers are playing all across Australia and New Zealand in July. Man, what a tour. You're starting in Canberra, Bendigo, Chelsea Heights, then Doncaster, Newcastle, Sydney. You're playing the Factory Theatre in Sydney. That is a huge place. That's like 1,500 seats or something.
Great.
Yeah. I saw, who did I say? I saw Biffy Clyro there a few years ago, another Scottish export. So,
yeah,
it's a fantastic place. You're going to love it there. Then you go off to Dapto, Rudy Hill RSL. I used to do stand-up comedy there, and those crowds are brutal, so you better watch yourself.
Yeah.
Of course, they'll probably love you more than they love me, so I'm sure it'll be fine.
Yeah, I've been there a few times. They're pretty good.
Good. All right. Well, make friends with the bouncer. That's the advice I can give you there.
Okay. Then,
Campbelltown, Revesby, Melbourne, Kingsford, Castle Hill, Tweed Heads, Brisbane, Perth, Adelaide, Auckland. That's in a month. Right? I mean, you're playing damn near every night. Then you start the UK tour, then hitting Ireland. So 2018 is a huge year for you. And but you look like you're in good shape. You look like you'll be able to make it no problems.
Yeah, I think so.
Great to see you playing and welcomed around the world. So everyone, go to lesmcewen.com. I'll have links on the Vinyl Guide. And Les, thanks again for joining us here.
Yep, you can even type in basicrollers.com. It'll take you to the same place.
Perfect. Even easier.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Les.
Thanks very much for having me on your show. I'm brilliant. Nice talking with you.
Great to have you.